gonna test. I'm just gonna test it to see if we have the right volume. Does that bother you? I'm gonna test this. I don't think it's working. Chair, move it over here by you. That's okay. You can just leave it right there. We can both use it. Just for the purposes of the tape today, I'm in Kotzebue, Alaska, and this is Mike Dalton. I'm just doing this for the purposes of the tape so we can identify him. This is September, about the 24th, isn't it, or 23rd? Must be the 24th.
24th.
1974, and I'm visiting with John Cross in Kotzebue, Alaska. Mr. Cross, how long have you lived in Kotzebue?
I came to Kotzebue first in 1936.
And
have living here. On and off ever since. At first I was stationed in Nome and flying out of Nome, but in Kotzebue every few days.
But you've lived here since 1936.
I have lived at this in this location here since the early 50s.
I see.
Built this house here in 57.
You built this house the same year we built our house. Are you familiar with Fairbanks?
Yes.
We live on the road, Yankovich Road, where the old Yankovich farm used to be, out in that area. And we built our place and started in 57. Finished it in 58.
I worked out of Fairbanks for Wayne a number of times. Mm-hmm. I came to Nome and Kotzebue for Noel Wayne in 36. Before that, I had was working for Cordova Air Service out of Cordova.
Oh, I see. How many years did you work out of Cordova?
I came there in 34. M.D. Kirkpatrick, who founded Cordova Air Service, and I worked together at Swallow Airfield in Wichita.
I see.
And I came north. I brought their first Belanca north. Incidentally, brought it on Alaska steamship from Seattle because we just didn't fly between Seattle and Alaska at that time. I was on active duty with the Air Corps, the Army Air Corps it was at that time, at Fort Riley when I got a message from M.D. Kirkpatrick to pick up a Belanca in Chicago and get it to Alaska. I flew it to Alaska from Chicago.
I flew
it to Seattle and put it on Alaska steamship there. And didn't intend to come north, but I had settled my flying business before I went on active duty, and there's no reason why I shouldn't, so I decided I'd see what was going on up north, and intended to turn around and come back. It was about 7 years before I got back, because they put me to work when I got north. Kirkpatrick had never flown a Belanca, so they helped him put the wings back on it, and flew with him for a while.
Out of Cordova, where did you fly mostly? To Valdez and Yakutat, or?
Some to Valdez, but mostly to the interior. McCarthy.
Oh, yes.
Copper Center.
Mm-hmm.
It is really a challenge there because of the difference in climate and weather between the interior and Cordova.
Right.
And later we worked with seaplanes. Worked on the islands there in Prince William Sound and with fisheries and and other things there. In fact, that's where I got my introduction to seaplane flying. Then in 36, I went to work for Noel Wayne, who had just taken over the Nome station and bought out an outfit that was flying out of there.
Did you meet Noel Wayne in Fairbanks?
I met him first when he flew into Cordova. He flew into Cordova quite regularly to pick up things from the boat there and flew them through to Fairbanks.
What happened to Kirkpatrick? Did he sell out, or is he still living in Alaska?
No. Kirkpatrick was killed in an accident just a few miles from Cordova after I left there. He's flying Kirkpatrick was very conservative with weather, but he would do almost anything to get home. If he got close to it, he would push the weather. And he ran into a snow squall just outside of Cordova and turned around at a low altitude and evidently hit the water.
Mm-hmm.
Near a cannery by Shepherd Point, you know, just close to the field, but on the other side of the mountain from the field at Cordova.
Well, let's go back to when were you born and where were you born?
I was born on a farm west of Wichita near the little town of Goddard. This is the 1st of March, 1895, they tell me.
1st of March, 1895. So you're getting up there, aren't you? You're close to 80?
I'll be 80 in less than 6 months.
Be 80 next March, 1st of March. Yeah. So it's near Goddard, Kansas. And was it a farm family that you were born into?
Yes.
You live on a farm?
Yes. My father and his father and father before him were farmers. The family came originally from England by way of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Michigan. Father was born in Michigan. I homesteaded east of Goddard, between Goddard and Wichita. In 1873. And I was born on the farm there. And owned a part of the farm until just a few years ago that I sold land there.
Did you, were you able to go through high school?
Yes.
A lot of the early farm boys didn't get a chance to go to school.
We had a little schoolhouse quarter mile away, a country school, and I went through the grades there, and then I went to the Friends University Academy. There wasn't a public high school at that time, but Friends University had an academy there.
Mm-hmm.
I went through that in 1 year of college at Friends, and then I went to Ottawa University in Eastern Kansas, in Ottawa, Eastern Kansas. I graduated there in 1918. I should have graduated in 18, but I went into the war, First World War, I dropped back and graduated with my wife, who graduated in 1819.
Okay, and that was... Ottawa, did they call it Ottawa?
Ottawa University at Ottawa, Kansas. It's the west of Kansas City.
And what did you study in college?
I was planning on studying medicine. I could have placed a major in either ancient language or in biology, and planned to go into medicine. But I got into, in my senior year, I went into the Army as a cadet.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out in the same year I graduated, that's 1819. And,
mm-hmm.
and went on the farm because during the Depression there wasn't much else going on. Then, since I had learned to fly, I was very much interested in that. I took that up.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would have taken it up earlier, but my mother was. She thought I'd taken enough risks during the war flying, and was very much opposed to me flying.
Yes.
So I didn't really go into it actively until her death in 1925. After that, I flew every chance. Of course, there was no aviation at that time.
During World War I, when you went into service, did you go into flying at that time?
Yes, I enlisted as a flying cadet.
And that's where you learned to fly?
Yes.
With the Army? Yeah. Army Air Corps?
Army Air Corps.
And where did you train?
I trained in Texas. First at the ground school in Austin, then at Everman, Texas.
Everman?
Everman. Everman. Just south of Fort Worth, Texas. It is called Barron Field. That was a field that was established by the Canadians for training while I was American cadets took over the field when the Canadians went back to Canada in the summer. They trained during the winter there and then went back to Canada. And we took that over in March of 18. And I finished my training there and went to Long Island on overseas orders. Stayed there waiting transportation until the armistice was signed. Then I went back to Texas for some more training.
So you didn't get over to
the... I didn't get overseas. I had under overseas orders for a number of months.
Mm-hmm.
But
do you still keep in contact with any of the World War I flyers you trained with or flew with? Do you know some of them?
There's none of them that I knew during the war that I in contact with now. Although I belong to an organization of known as the Ordre des Dedalians.
Dedalians?
Dedalians.
Now, the Order of the Dedalians, that's spelled Daedalians, and according to your publication, this is a roster of members as of July 1st, 1974. that says it's established on the 26th of March, 1934 at Maxwell Field, Alabama. And you, Mr. Cross, said you are a founder member.
Yes, the founder members are those who held a commission and a flying rating before the armistice in 1918.
I see.
Other members are the hereditary and named members. A founder member can name members, mm-hmm. or it can name my son, Gordon, is also a member.
Is your son a flyer also?
What?
Is your son a flyer?
Yes, he is a captain on with Wayne Airlines.
Oh, I see.
He's not a military pilot,
mm-hmm.
and would not be eligible as a named pilot, but he was a hereditary pilot.
So having the hereditary membership will keep the organization alive.
Yes, and a member can name three others if they meet certain requirements.
Yes.
Being a flying rating and a commission. They have quite a program of promoting standards in the various divisions of the Air Force and other organizations,
mm-hmm.
and recognizing pilots for special performance, things of that kind.
Now, the membership is listed here, but it's just in alphabetical order. It's not divided by... Oh, it gives the city and state, though, doesn't it?
It's in alphabetical order.
I'm just looking for your name here. Here we are. Here's Gordon Cross.
That is my son.
Of Anchorage. And John M. Cross, Box 23, Kotzebue, Alaska, Lieutenant Colonel. You were retired as a Lieutenant Colonel?
Yes.
Okay. That's something I didn't know existed, but I'm glad to find out.
Polar Flight Number 10 is a local organization in Elmendorf Air Force Base.
Polar Flight Number 10, and that's the Alaska chapter.
Yes.
And you are the only founder member of
in
the
that,
Alaska chapter.
Yeah. The surprising number of those surviving founder members, so I...
Mm-hmm.
3 years ago, I attended the annual convention down in Alabama, Maxwell Field, and I think there was something over 300 of us,
mm-hmm.
founder members.
Where do they have their convention this year?
I'm not sure. Last year it was Dayton. And I'm not sure where to have this.
Just to get off the subject just a little bit, in your flying experiences, did you ever meet or were you ever associated with Lindbergh?
I've met him a number of times. He was flying at the same time that I was flying out of the fields at Wichita.
Mm-hmm.
And knew him, although I never worked with him, and I couldn't say that I was that he was a close friend of mine, because it was just meeting casually.
I was just looking to see if he was a member of this. I don't see his name, no. Then you were discharged then from the Air Corps in 1918. You went back to...
In 1919, I left in February of 1919. And then I took a commission in 1923.
So you went back in?
Reserve, as a reserve commission. I didn't go on active duty in 23. But after that, in the latter 20s, I attended training sessions during the summer until I came to Alaska in 34. And I was active in the reserve. We did a great deal of flying out of Kansas City. I belonged to a squadron at headquarters in Kansas City, and go out and dedicate airports and that sort of thing at that time. Mm-hmm. Around 1930, there was a great deal of activity, of course, in flying, establishing airports and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they call on the Air Reserve. We were using the old open cockpit biplanes, yeah, of course. I wasn't active in reserve except in flying. I got credit for a certain a part of my civilian flying, so I kept my commission until I went on active duty in November of 41.
I was going to lead up to the World War II. With your background in flying in the Air Corps, you must have been put into active duty during World War II.
Yes. I spent 3.5 years, and I put in something over 1,100 hours as a pilot. But I was with the service command. I worked first with cold weather tests under Gaffney at Fairbanks. Then I went with the 11th Air Force Service Command, first at Anchorage and out on the chain on briefly escorting senior officers. I was a major at that time. And then I took command of the Naknek Air Base at King Salmon. Mm-hmm. And I was there until I was relieved from active duty and went on reserve status again. But
when was that you went back into inactive status? What year?
1945, I believe.
So you spent about four years during World War II on active duty?
Yes, that's about 3.5 years. Yes.
And you retired with the rate or the rating of a lieutenant colonel?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I held that while I was I was in command of the air base at Naknek. Mm-hmm.
The last January was I went out to the Aleutian Chain for the first time, and when I went out there, I took that little book, The Thousand Mile War, and then I finished reading it when I came home, but I was able to see some of the spots where Japanese troops had actually occupied the Aleutians, and there's still lots of relics of the war out there. Did you do any active flying out there, or were your trips just out and back, or were you stationed out there at any time?
I was I I went out to ADAC when we first moved into ADAC. I went with a senior officer of the supply quartermaster corps. Was sent out there to straighten out some of the supplies as they were unloading there. And since he'd never been in Alaska and wasn't familiar with it, I was sent along. That was just before I went to Jeneknik Air Base. I was, at that time, I was working with the 11th Air Force Service Command and had an office in Anchorage.
In Anchorage.
Yeah, I was, work there was coordinating the cold weather work. Mm-hmm. Good many of the airplanes come up weren't in any condition to fly.
Right.
And the...
Well, they had no experience in Arctic or subarctic flying. The Air Corps had no practical experience before World War II. I don't think they did anyway. Maybe I'm wrong.
Very, very little.
Yeah.
They had a flight up here quite early. They flew the old B-10s. Martin. But that was just a summer flight and
mm-hmm.
back. And there was very little in Alaska. There were a few pursuit-type aircraft at Anchorage. But we just didn't have combat aircraft until we got into the war.
Yes.
We had some good cross-country aircraft that carried a few guns, but they were not really combat aircraft until we got into the fight.
In your duty during World War II, were you ever involved with the transshipment of or flying of the aircraft from the United States through Nome and over into Russia?
They started moving them just about the time I left Fairbanks and went to Anchorage and had some contact with the Russians there. And then, of course, after that, whenever I was at Nome or Fairbanks, I ran across them.
Their route was to Fairbanks. Wasn't it up through Canada and into Fairbanks?
They went to, yes.
And into Nome?
The Russians usually picked up the aircraft at Fairbanks.
Right.
And
then they refueled at Nome?
And yes. There's of course, a world of very interesting and bizarre happenings in that.
Mm-hmm.
These men that came in were survivors of outfits that had been in combat, and this was more or less of a recreation ferrying the aircraft over for them. So most of those pilots were
combat veterans.
Yeah. Is it their attitude was reflected, their experience reflected in their attitude toward, like, one man was who understood English quite well was talking to one of our officers about using aircraft against tanks. And he said, we see tanks are coming in and we know they're going to go at us, hit our line at a certain place. So we get the aircraft and dive and shoot out, drop a bomb, and we just keep on until they have to disperse. And our officer said, but don't you lose a lot of aircraft on that? Sure. What's the matter? You afraid to die? In other words, it was they expected to lose a great many aircraft, they stopped the tank from breaking through their lines.
Yeah.
And that reflected their attitude. Another thing that I observed that was their hunger for supplies and things that they would shop in the stores and pick up things for their women that they couldn't get
buy in Russia.
And one plane that was spattered all over the tundra there in Eastern Nome had canned goods all over. They had stocked up on canned goods.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there was no reason why they shouldn't, of course.
They didn't exist probably in Russia at that time. They probably still were.
They just weren't available.
Yeah.
And
I'm gonna have
there was one thing that is very that happened there with a pilot that I knew very well, made the rescue. It was a twin engine fighter. The British call them a DB-7, a dive bomber, 7. It's a twin engine fighter with the man in the back seat. There were two men in it, and this was flying alone, and